Jared Whateley is from ABC Grandstand and the author of Black Caviar, The Horse of a Lifetime. Hello, Jared.
Trevor, good morning.
Hey, Jared, when you take a look at a horse that comes through racing, and as you've put in the title here, The Horse of a Lifetime, is it more than just being a great racehorse and one that wins that makes it the horse of a lifetime?
Yes, I think it is. And this is, I guess, what we've lived through, is there's this unbroken lineage of champion racehorses that Australia's had. And I think Australia has a peculiar and distinctive relationship with its great horses, where they do get elevated to almost hero status in our sporting culture beyond what happens in other countries. And it's a lineage that begins with Carbine and runs through the likes of Burnborough and Tullock and Kingston Town and Maccabi Diva. But there's two that their deeds sort of resonated well beyond first racing and then sport, and became sort of part of who we are and how we measured ourselves as Australians and how we measured our success. And they were Farlap and Black Caviar. So it was more than what happened on the track. It was she had this particular way of giving people an emotional stake when she ran, and whether that was hard-bitten punters in soulless TABs or racing agnostics, is people actually cared when she ran as to whether she could, continue to defy the very notion of sport, that in the end they all get beaten. And she's made invincibility, which is long thought to be sort of fleeting in sport, to be lasting and perhaps permanent.
When you compare perhaps Farlap with Black Caviar, Farlap, there was almost a need for a nation to have something to follow because of the economic circumstances around Farlap. Is there something different about that about Black Caviar?
I suppose people chose to follow her. It's very difficult. There's such a great body of work around Farlap, but there's sort of not those day-by-day accounts as to what impact he had. There's the broad brush that he sort of carried the nation through and through the Depression and gave people great hope. And I think what Black Caviar did was sort of send people's spirits soaring when she ran. And that's linked to, I think, sort of the three aspects, one being pure speed, which, you know, the very purpose of racing, and this is true whether it's humans or cars or bikes or horses, is to find the fastest. And she was the fastest of them all. And the second was that notion of invincibility. And the third was the intangible, being able to sort of break through and become this touchstone. She became a touchstone of how we measured success. And I think we saw this at the London Olympics, where the two iconic gold medals of Australia's campaign were Anna Mears, and at the velodrome after she'd beaten Victoria Pendleton and rode around to her family to embrace them over the barricades, they were holding a sign and it said Black Caviar on wheels. And then there was Sally Pearson, and in her lead up to the Olympics, where she went that period of time over 12 months unbeaten, she was given the moniker that seemed very fitting for the fastest Australian female on two legs of Blonde Caviar. So she became the prism through which all measure of Australian sporting success was measured over this period.
It's interesting for people, I don't follow horse racing and know very little about it. In fact, most of my horse racing knowledge comes from watching films like Secretariat. So that's very limited. But it's interesting coming in late, because I only really started to hear about Black Caviar after the sixth, seventh race when she had that winning streak. And is that when the momentum started to build?
Yeah, it was surprising how quickly that it did build. The record number for an Australian horse throughout history from the beginning of a career of consecutive wins was 9. And she was at this sort of serious figure by race sort of 6 and 7 and 8. But by her 10th run, which was the record breaker, and it was the Newmarket Handicap, where she had to carry a record weight and she ran the fastest time ever recorded in what is the sprinting equivalent to the Melbourne Cup. She'd made that leap beyond the racing landscape. And that was the day where the VRC printed commemorative postcards immediately after the race and handed them out. And they asked Peter Moody and Luke Nolan to come down and sign a few after the last race. And everyone expected that they'd be signing for about 10 minutes. And they ended up signing for an hour and a half of a line that just continued to replenish. And they would sit there and joke with each other that when they left school, here were two blokes who could barely write their own names, and here they were sort of signing mementos. And from there, that became one of the permanents of any day when she raced, was those who went wanted to collect a milestone, collect a memento of the day. And Moody and Nolan were forever signing various bits and pieces. And Moody's favourite request was from a fellow who had nothing else but a cigarette paper, and that spoke very much to Peter's heart.
We've got lots of people wanting to join us, so we'll take calls. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning.
Yes, Jack.
Look, I want to forget his name. No,
Jared.
Okay. Yeah. His opinion on the time form, the placing Frankel 10 points above Black Caviar.
Now, Jared, you'll need to tell us who Frankel is for listeners who aren't aware.
Yep. There's been this marvellous symmetry that at the same time that Black Caviar has been here, the English have had a horse named Frankel who's gone through his career, which is now completed, unbeaten, and he won 14 races. He has world rankings above Black Caviar on the performances, certainly in the second half of his career. And having seen them both in the flesh, I was lucky enough to see Frankel at Royal Ascot. I have no doubt that he's the best horse probably that the world's ever seen. But the interesting part of that was on that Tuesday at Royal Ascot, and he won the Queen Anne Stakes by a staggering 11 lengths. It was genuinely, and I think compellingly argued, that that was the greatest gallop of all time. And when it was written about in the English papers, those stories ran in the racing pages. He couldn't even break out of the racing pages into the sporting pages, let alone onto the front of the newspapers. And when Black Caviar ran on the Saturday, on the Sunday papers in Britain, she carried the front page of two of them, page three of three others, and then was littered throughout the sporting section. So this is why I say she became this cultural phenomenon that even the greatest horse perhaps of all time simply couldn't bridge.
Does Frankel run over different distances to Black Caviar?
He does, and he's quite a monstrous horse, the way that he would demoralise his fields over sort of 1,600 metres and 2,000 metres. So they're vastly different horses, but again, this is where it gets back to you don't need to compare the racetrack deeds of Farlap and Black Caviar to understand the similarities. And where Black Caviar totally outshines Frankel is on that impact that she's left on a society.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. I was, if I might ask Gerard a question. Presumably you watched her win at Ascot. On a video, as I did about 10 times, and it seemed to me that, she definitely lunged at the end in time, obviously with her galloping, to lean forward and just pip the other horse because she stretched her head out. Did you notice that?
Yes. I was fortunate enough to be at Ascot, and it's a remarkable ending to the story, which is sort of documented for the first time in the book. And so much went wrong for Black Caviar, not only that day, but in the lead-up to it. And Peter Moody had these 4 days of anxiety trying to decide whether to run her or not. She had various sort of injuries and niggles, and she was completely exhausted. She hadn't handled the travel in the manner that he'd hoped. And for Luke Nolan, the jockey, he didn't know any of the background, but it was an uneasy ride from the outset. And he was sort of much criticised for his easing up of Black Caviar, where he was trying to be kind to her at the end, realising that all wasn't right. And he had this startling moment about 5 strides from the line where he saw the French horse coming on his left, and he saw her for the first time. And he had that quick calculation as to where the finishing post was and where the French filly was, and realised that they weren't quite going to make it. So Black Caviar had no physical capability to sort of pick up and continue to offer a second effort. So all he could do was flatten her head out, which is one of the early techniques that you're taught as an apprentice jockey. And they've got this relationship over 19 races and many mornings together at track work, where as soon as Nolan asked her to stretch her head out, she responded immediately. And had they not done that, they wouldn't have won. And his explanations of what happened in the final moments of that race were captivating. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to sit with him and hear those, and they do come across very much that way in the book.
Got a bit goosebumpy on that. That really highlights the important relationship between jockey and horse, especially in this case.
Yes, and had that not been the case, had an English jockey been aboard or a jockey for the first time, I feel certain that she would have been beaten. That there is this connection between those with the long-term relationships, which is very understandable. I think you can relate it back to your relationship with your pet.
Yep.
And that's very much what's at play here with a horse and a jockey.
Let's go back. And as I said, most of my knowledge of horse racing comes through watching movies. And in Secretariat, there was a lineage that brought Secretariat to the fore. Is there a similar thing in Caviar, Black Caviar? Is there something there that people went, yes, well, there is this horse or that horse that brings that sort of breeding that will make Black Caviar a great horse?
Actually, for Rick Jamieson, who's the breeder, it was a huge gamble in the direction that he went. There is a lot of talent back through the pedigree, sprinting talent. And for Peter Moody, he had a sprinter named Magnus, who was just short of being a star sprinter, and he would run second in a lot of the top level races behind the likes of Takeover Target and Miss Andretti, who were the best sprinters of the day. And so there was a close relative in the Black Caviar breeding that attracted Moody immediately to go and have a look at this filly. As you can imagine, at the yearling sales, there's 570 odd lots that come in a catalogue, and a trainer goes through and looks for some fleck of recognition, some reason to go and have a look at a horse, and that was the reason for him. The breeder, Rick Jamieson, had gone to a sale looking for a broodmare in Sydney and hadn't found anything to his liking. In the supplementary sale, so the secondary sort of off-Broadway part of the sale, he found what he liked, and that was an unraced mare with a strong pedigree. So he took the gamble on a horse that had never seen the racetrack and bought her. Took her back to Gilgai Farm, which was his property, and then had to first name her and then work out which sire to send her to. And he did say to the farm manager, he sort of passed off the job of naming the mare. And the farm manager, who I take it has a good sense of humour, figured, well, this was a horse that was never going to appear in a form guide. It was never going to have its name called out across a race course, so why waste a good name on it? So he submitted the name Like Billy-O. And you can imagine, if Like Billy-O had gone through, then maybe the fastest horse we'd ever seen might have had the word goat in its name, for instance. Anyway, Rick decided that wouldn't do, and the mother was Scandinavia, so he named the horse Helsing. And then he sent Helsing to what had been a new sire, Bel Esprit, who was a champion two-year-old of his day. He won the Blue Diamond and a couple of other handy races along the way. But if you have a mare without any racetrack form and you send it to a sire who's new onto the scene, then the horse you produce needs to be good, because if you're not, then you've probably got a failure that will resonate down the line and you'll never be able to sell the yearling. Mm. So for Rick, it was a huge gamble, but now he's created a dynasty, because the close relation here, that the half-brother is named All Too Hard, so he's two further down the line from Black Caviar, and he won the Caulfield Guinea 3 weeks ago and ran second in the Cox Plate last week.
Actually, Kath picked him. That was a good bet that we actually won on that one.
Yeah.
So when you look at that, how much did they pay for Black Caviar?
They paid just more than $200,000, and for this was a group of owners who had, you know, been bound together by the generations. They'd had grandparents who were in the northeast part of Melbourne, and they'd had children who'd gone to school together. So these were sort of firm family friends, and some of them were related. And on a river cruise on the Murray River one year, while the red wine was flowing one night, they decided, you know what we should do? We should buy a racehorse. and they came together at the perfect moment and lodged an order with Peter Moody to buy a filly when the next one came up. Moody thought, or Neil Werrett and his group were prepared to pay $100,000, and Moody ended up paying $200,000. So they had this moment where the five couples had to decide, were they prepared to double what they'd committed, or were they either going to pass or share the horse with somebody else? And they decided that they would double their investment, and they more than doubled their funds.
Certainly have. Tell us about the trainers.
Peter Moody is the trainer, and he's sort of the most compelling figure in the book, I think, in terms of a human. He was born in outback Queensland, and he's not old by any stretch, but he was born at a time where Wyandra, his hometown, wasn't even connected to the electricity grid. So this was the real desolate, dusty outback of Queensland. His family had a long heritage in frontier farming, so he was born onto a cattle and sheep station, and there was alcoholism close up in the family. And he knew he's an intriguing figure, and from his earliest days, he understood that his way out of this life was through horses. So he taught himself. He put himself close to the old trainers of the district, who were sort of, he would describe them as rough old bastards, sort of an ex-pug and a foreman from a road crew who'd taken to horse racing, and he learnt all he could there. And then as a teenager, he knew his own mind, and he went and he worked for the three greatest trainers Australia has ever known. That was Tommy Smith, Colin Hayes and Bart Cummings. And he learnt all that he could there. And then he struck out alone, and first as a foreman, then as an assistant trainer, and then in his own right, first in Brisbane and then in Melbourne. And he rose to the top of the Melbourne training ranks simply by being the best at his craft. He was a self-made man in an industry where a lot of these empires are inherited. And it's the timing is probably so important here, as he'd already become the leading trainer when he found Black Caviar. So he had the knowledge to select her and the wherewithal to train her, and then the ambition to build the legend that he has done.
Good morning, Bill.
Oh, good morning. Yes, she's got a half-brother running up in Broome too, Isbin. He's won a few races in Broome.
Do you know about that one, Jared?
I've heard that story, but I haven't seen it myself.
Yep.
I know that there's been the three here that we've seen race, Black Caviar, Moshe, who was moderately talented and is heading to stud, and All Too Hard, who's a complete star. Mm. And the next yearling sold for, I think it was $2.6 million.
Yeah.
It's a two-year-old now, so we'll see it soon enough. And the next one will come to market in early next year, I think. And it's a colt by Redoute's Choice, and it'll probably sell for $5 or $6 or $7 million, I think.
Now, what else did you want to say, Bill?
What did she run, Jared? What did she run the day she beat Haylist? You know, she really pulled out all stops, and she ran a 200 metres in probably, was it under 10 seconds?
Yeah, this was in the Lightning Stakes, and I think we'd all wondered if she was ever actually under serious challenge, how fast could she go? And between the 600 metres and the 400 metres that day down the straight, when Haylist was seriously challenging her, she ran in 9.96 seconds, a 200 metre sectional. Now, this was, nobody really ever thought this was physically possible, and it certainly had never been recorded before, and subsequently no evidence has come to light of a horse ever covering 200 metres in less than 10 seconds. And this is why I say we definitively know her to be the fastest of them all, because of that moment in that race. And it was a day that was, it was electrifying to watch, but it was in the aftermath when those times started to come in and you realised how fast she had gone, that there's such a legend that lives in that moment too.
Actually, I've got a text here that asks if she's actually, if she holds any race or course records.
She doesn't actually hold a course record. She certainly holds race records, and that Newmarket that she won with 58 kilos, she broke the race record in that, and that's a race that had been run more than 130 times. But we know of her style is, once she had races won, there wasn't the extra exertion to smash the clock as well. And that was because she was always, she was a hugely physical creature who had she had injuries the whole way through her career. So Peter Moody and Luke Nolan had always decided that winning was the goal rather than running times. But when she did need to run times, she has run that fastest 200 metres ever seen anywhere in the world.
Norm.
Thank God for Haylis, because the only horse that can give her a bloody run. This is completely over the top. Great horses. If that horse had lost the first or second race, it would have been a good horse, but nobody would have raved on about it. Great horses win Melbourne Cups, Cox Plates, Caulfield Cups, Golden Slippers, Blue Diamonds, Derbies. Haylis, Black Caviar haven't won those races.
But aren't they distant? But aren't they different distance races, Norm?
Yeah, but I'm telling you, Golden Slippers, Blue Diamonds, the shorter ones, she hasn't won those. They're the great races.
I'll go back to Jared. Do you want to comment?
She's won 22 races from 22 starts. It was the most glorious stat in the history of the Australian turf. Great horses don't win Golden Slippers and Blue Diamonds. That's just simply not true. I doubt many people could ring up now and name 10 of them who have done that. This horse has become part of who we are through her winning. And I always sort of pose this question back: is the greatest feat in the Australian turf until this was Farlap winning on the 4 days of the Melbourne Cup Carnival in 1930? So we know we won the Cup on the Tuesday. What races did he win on the Saturday and the Thursday and the following Saturday? And who did he beat? And how far did he win them by? And how many runners were in them? Is nobody remembers these things because the whole purpose is winning. That's where it lives. And that's why her deeds will resonate for generations to come.
In that case, if you then take a look at other races, other periods of time, have we ever had other sprinters that would compare? And along with that, if you go internationally, other sprinters that would compare that she may not have raced against?
Yeah, the great sprinters of the world have usually been Australian horses, and certainly the benchmark before Black Caviar, who was sort of jealously guarded in his reputation, was Vane. And Vane not only dominated the sprinting ranks, but he could stretch out to further distances as well. So he was the benchmark. But the interesting part is right now, and we see this develop each year with our cups, is Australia. What Australia does is breed sprinters by the bucketful to the expense of all else. We have our iconic race over 2 miles, and yet the industry no longer breeds with any purpose staying horses. We breed sprinters and we seed them around the rest of the world. So at a time when this is actually what we do best in the world, we've come out with the best figure in sprinting history. So I think it's particularly notable that it's happened at this moment in time.
As I said, Jared Whateley from ABC Grandstand and the author of Black Caviar, The Horse of a Lifetime, is my guest. Hello, Ken.
What I find exciting and interesting about Black Caviar is that whereas Farlap was achieved his greatness and thrilled us during the Great Depression, Black Caviar has achieved her greatness and thrilled us during the Great Recession. I remember seeing her at the Lightning Stakes at Randwick on television, and the way she gave Haylis the start at the top of the straight, and there's a rise at Randwick, and she beat him. But there was a close-up angle of them going side by side, like head to head, and her acceleration was just so much faster than his, and you could see that that's why she gave him a start and a beating.
Jared,
a freakish anomaly, I suppose, was to have this tremendously long stride. So while Haylis would take 15 strides to cover the last 200 metres of that race, is she would take 13 strides. So she had this inherent advantage that she could cover more ground expending less energy. And that was the day that Black Caviar tended to win her races in the middle stages on most days. She would break her rivals by going so quickly that they didn't have the speed nor the stamina to keep up. That was the day that Haylis shot 5 lengths clear of her up the rise at Randwick, and she sort of fully coiled and came with this exhilarating and concentrated burst to go past Haylis. And the startling part of that was Haylis was still getting away from the rest of the field, and yet she ran past him like he was nailed to the fence. It was probably the best finish to a run in her entire career.
A text here that says, from Robin Hawthorn, what are the physical attributes that make Black Caviar different to other sprinters?
Yeah, is that stride length. And this was something that had been countenanced in the past. It was thought that Burnborough had an extraordinary long stride, and he was the champion horse of the 40s. And so there are those who would sort of devote themselves to finding horses with this long stride. And that was her thing. She would, if you can sort of picture when a horse moves to go faster, their action would be quicker, their legs would pump faster. She wouldn't do that. She would actually lower her frame, Peter Moody would say, about 6 inches, and stretch further with every stride. So instead of quickening, she would actually lengthen. And that was what made her quite distinctive.
And is it the power from, because I guess the power comes from the backside.
It does. So she's much bigger than most mares. Her racing weight was about 580 kilos. But she was always perfectly balanced. So her front hooves were quite lithe on the ground, but she would plant, coil and propel from the hindquarters. And that's why she was so good down the straight at Flemington, is because she would run dead straight because of this great sense of balance that was provided by the power from the back and the light touch on the ground in front.
Because I've always wondered what trainers do. Is that something that's trained into a horse, or is that something that comes instinctively?
Both. But she obviously had a tremendous natural aptitude right from the start for it. And Moody will say that is the first time he sort of sent her out at full gallop, he realised immediately that he had something quite sort of abnormal and special that you need to, you then need to sort of nurture and educate. And her inabilities at the start were really leaving the barriers. She had a devil of a time in her first sort of half dozen starts getting out of the gates. At her fourth start, she buckled over and sort of almost went down on her nose and her knees and tore all the muscles in the front of her chest. And she was still able to win that race. But one of the keys there was being able to train her to just leave the gates smoothly, not quickly, but just to step away with or just behind the rest of the field and balance up and then use her natural speed once she was in full stride.
Cameron, good morning. You there, Cameron?
Yes, I am.
Yep, off you go.
Just a question for Jared. I'm just wondering why, I think I'm an avid a fan of Black Caviar, as Jared is. I'm wondering why he's chosen to write the book now and not perhaps in a couple of months, well, maybe 6 months' time when she's maybe run her last race.
The main reason was the blur of hindsight, and this is why we do sort of quite a lot of writing along the way, was if you leave everything until the end and then try to remember each day as it was, there's that natural human blurring of what actually happened. And the owners will say when they read pieces along the way that they couldn't remember anymore what had happened on those days, but it is captured at the time that it happened. And the second is, you know, it's quite simple. If you go to a bookshop now, there's a book on Bart Cummings, and there's a book on Gay Waterhouse, and there's a book on Roger Federer, and there's a book on Rafael Nadal, and there's numerous books on Tiger Woods. Is when we're sort of most, when broadly those of us who aren't, you know, the hardcore audience for Black Caviar are most interested, is people want to know about it. Now, her career sort of may or may not be over right now, although the day after Ascot, Peter Moody did ring the owners and say that 99% sure she was going to be retired at that stage. And then that's changed for hopefully a farewell tour. But this is the, you know, this is the moment where it's she's been of peak interest to the nation. And the stories are documented along the way so that, you know, for future generations, for my kids, is there'll be the day-by-day account of what happened and what it meant, and very particularly how it felt, not only for those closely involved, but the nation more broadly.
Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, Elizabeth.
That's really interesting. Many years of living in Hong Kong, and then in this last year, from October to October, because of circumstances, I ended up homeless. And listening to Black Caviar's history lifted me out of a sort of depression. But I remember those years in Hong Kong of having that gut feeling for names and numbers and number 8 and Black Caviar and her strengths gave me an incredible amount of hope. And I can remember going to the Sha Tin race course with some friends of mine in Hong Kong who were very into the racing scenario, and the amount that was betted on one Saturday, and this is going back to the 80s, one Saturday afternoon was, you would hear people betting, say, 10,000 Hong Kong in the queue ahead of you, was more than the whole year of Australian racing.
It's something amazing about her that people have drawn strength from her in many different ways, Elizabeth. Thank you. We'll just go back to some more calls. Hello, Jeff.
Yeah, good day, mate. How are you going?
Good, Jeff.
Yeah, Jared, look, great book, mate. I've just started reading it. And the first section on Peter Moody, what a character. Absolutely, well, terrifically written.
Thank you.
I have a question, as you're well aware, with horse racing. When you take a horse overseas, one of the major things is, you know, familiarisation and taking them out of the comfort zone, etc. Why did they not take his female strapper?
The closest relationship, as I guess there were two figures, is Donna Fisher and Tony Hayden, and Tony Hayden was the assistant trainer. So they chose to take Tony rather than Donna. And Tony has a very close relationship with her as well. He lives at the stables at Caulfield where the Moody operation runs, and he was probably the most constant figure in Black Caviar's life. Moody had the difficulty as he had basically the 3-week expedition, or probably 4 weeks in the end, to London, and he had the whole team back here as he pushed on to win the trainer's premiership. So he had to divide the team up into what needed to run the rest of the operation in Melbourne over that time and what should and could go to London. So he had that difficult choice, and he took Tony rather than Donna. So,
why didn't he take both?
Because Donna had a senior role back in Melbourne.
Okay.
To run the stable through the last couple of months of the season. And they were winning, I can remember on one of the days over there in the reports back home, that they were winning, I think they won 4 races at Caulfield in the lead up to Ascot. So Moody, you know, even though things changed the longer it went, he was always mindful that he had to train the rest of a large team, as well as this one great horse, because if something happened to Black Caviar, he, you know, the rest of it was actually the core business.
Yep. Mary.
Oh, hello. Oh, I love this horse. Oh, I backed against it that many times, it's not better.
Why did you back against it?
Because I thought it can't possibly keep on winning. And it did. So I gave up backing against it, watching it winning. And when it went to England, oh, believe it or not, I woke up, I think it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it nearly got done. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to cry my eyes out. It's done. It only got done. It nearly got done by half a head. I couldn't believe it. And I backed all too hard, and I couldn't believe that it could run 2,400 metres. Can Black Caviar run that distance?
I'm sure Black Caviar would have been a champion miler if the story had gone in a different direction, and probably if she'd been beaten earlier on, Moody would have had the capacity to experiment with her in the same way you would normally with horses. And to see all too hard run so strongly in the Cox Plate over 2,040 metres was probably to take a guess that she could have got that distance. But right from the outset, when she was a young horse, he thought she would be a 1,600-metre mile horse. It's just that I guess he never had the need or perhaps the luxury to try once she started to sort of rack up what was a set of wins that would send her into folklore.
As Mary was saying, like she kept on explicitly, like she had to be beaten at some time.
Yep.
Was there ever a feeling within the camp that she could be beaten by anything, or was there just this firm conviction that she can't be beaten?
No, they always thought she would get beaten because that's just the way of racing until the end of the first road trip. So Sydney and Brisbane, which was starts 12 and 13, they still figured at some point along the way she would get beaten then. But once they got through all of that, is from the next spring carnival, Moody, who's as pragmatic a man as you would come across, he actually held to the view that she would actually not get beaten unless something went wrong. And that's actually what happened at Ascot. There's a whole lot of things went wrong, and yet she was still able to win. So she didn't win on sort of talent and speed and ability that day. She won on heart and courage. So she had the whole spectrum covered.
Nice text here from Ricky. When Cummings took Saintly to Japan, he was never the same again. Moody said he nearly didn't run her. Do you think Australia is too far to travel for a horse race?
It's just there are peculiarities and vagaries with travelling horses that some do and some don't. And Saintly nearly died going to Japan. And Black Caviar didn't handle the trip as well as they would have hoped. But it's the same coming this way. Some of the Cups horses from Europe do acclimatise and some of them don't. And I guess the lessons of the past have been it's not always about ability. It's about how they handle the travel and how they settle in and whether they thrive here. And that's why a horse like, say, Media Puzzle, who wasn't nearly as good as his stablemate Vinnie Rowe, but in Australia, one handled it so much better than the other, and the horse who had been inferior in Europe became quite dominant in Australia.
Now, you know that the ABC News stops for nobody. In 30 seconds, can you just tell us, do you think she'll come back for a final tour?
I think it's 50-50. She's had a little excursion back to the Caulfield stables. Peter Moody will certainly try for a farewell tour, three runs, perhaps Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. If she stands up to the physical work, we'll see her again. And if she doesn't, she'll be retired.
Jared, thank you very much for joining us.
Good on you, Trevor. Cheers.
Jared Whateley from ABC Grandstand and the author of Black Caviar, The Horse of a Lifetime. And thank you to everybody who joined us. Great conversation.